from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, veteran Bay Area naturalist and adventure travel guide Michael Ellis joins us on the program. He's hula-hooped on top of a termite mound in Botswana and survived a near-death experience with a buffalo in Tanzania. He also leads regular trips around the Bay. He'll share tales from his recent adventures and will get his tips for the best places to see wildflowers, whales, and waterfalls this spring. And we'll take your questions on travel and the natural world. That's coming up after the news. Welcome back to the Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. Michael Ellis joins us in the studio for this Forum Hour. He's a longtime local naturalist and adventure travel guide, and we're going to talk with him about the most dramatic Bay Area waterfall hikes, the best places to spot wildflowers, and his tips for summer travel and more. And welcome, Michael Ellis.
It's good to be here again, Michael. Nice to see you.
Always good to have you here. And let me give out the number, because there are always people who want to talk to you and get your advice and sage advice. It often is. Usually is, in fact. What questions do you have for Michael Ellis on what you would want to like to explore or should explore next in Bay Area nature? You can call us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. The number again to call on, it's toll-free, is 866-733-6786. Or post questions or comments you might have on our website at kqed.org/forum or on Facebook, or tweet us at kqedforum. Or, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org.
Why do we say still toll-free? Everybody's got toll-free numbers now.
Well, people are listening to us all, believe it or not, all around the world, like you. You have naturalist trips all around the world. We have listeners all around the world. It surprises me how people call us from places all across the globe. But let's talk about what's really of interest to our local Bay Area listeners most of all. It's that time of year, it's spring, and we're coming upon April, which may indeed be the cruelest month, but not in terms of necessarily of nature. Let's talk about places for wildflowers. I already promoted this. Let's start, though, with waterfalls this spring. Where should people go?
Oh, well, my favorite one is Alamere Falls, which is in the south end of Point Reyes. You have to go to Bolinas if you can find Bolinas, and then hike in the coastal trail about 4.5 miles, I think. And so that one this time of year is going to be popping. Really nice, actually. Really nice waterfall.
And wildflowers, I know people still pick them for romantic purposes.
You know, the Sherpas, they have two great sayings. They said there's two sins in the world, great sins in the world. One is to threaten small children, and the other is to pick wildflowers.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I thought that was good. So please don't pick the wildflowers.
But they still do that for romantic purposes.
Yeah, well, pick them out of somebody's yard where they planted them intentionally. And speaking of April as the cruelest month, my lilacs are not even close to blooming right now. So I know you're a literary guy.
References to The Wasteland, which
T.S. Eliot, yeah.
It's still a morbid poem, but go ahead.
It is a morbid poem. Well, it's a little delayed, actually, because of the rain. And I'm curious now about some of the wildflower sites, because the grass has grown so high. Sometimes if it hadn't had quite so much rain, the flowers are a little bit more obvious. And now they're going to be covered up with grass that's popping up. But Edgewood Park, which is really nice. My favorite place, Edgewood is in San Mateo County, and it's got a serpentine outcroppings. And so a number of endemic plants. Point Reyes anywhere, but especially Chimney Rock. And what I like about Chimney Rock, this will probably be good in a couple of weeks, is not only do you have a nice wildflower display, you also have mom and baby gray whales on their northward migration that you get to see. And now, of course, you have the elephant seals, which are right there as well. So there's like a triple whammy there at point. And then Mount Diablo, which is super nice.
Wait, hold that thought, because I think Marion Hayward wanted to say something about Mount Diablo, and she's on the line here. Mary, hi.
Oh, perfect.
Yes, I've heard that there are waterfalls on Mount Diablo, but I have not ever seen them. So when is the best time, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, there is a nice waterfall in Mitchell Canyon. I was just about to mention that. It's a vernal one, which means it's only during the wet season. And Mitchell Canyon is on the north east side of Mount Diablo. And I was going to mention that as one of the great wildflower displays. An easy walk. It's flat at the beginning. Watch for rattlesnakes.
And do not pick the wildflowers.
Don't pick the wildflowers. And then there's a waterfall at the top of that, just as you start ascending the hill. But the nice thing about being on this program, Michael, is, you know, we're listening to this this beautiful audience out there that responds to things. And so what we'll get is we'll get somebody that knows Mount Diablo because it's in their backyard, and they're going to call in and they're going to tell us about all those great waterfalls.
Or they can email us, forum@kqed.org, and that's how we do indeed gather even more information. You know, I was reading something that you said that really struck me. You said you like to catch lizards and then let them go because it's the kid in you, the little boy in you. And, you know, I used to do the same thing, and I still like to do it, although I don't do it as I did as a kid. But I really, as a kid, just used to go. And here's a caller who's talking about protecting newts. Norma Jean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael and Michael.
Hi.
We have a road in Los Gatos on which there's been a big article in the San Jose Mercury News with the California newt migrating to the pond they must migrate to in order to mate and lay eggs. A woman scientist has documented 2,600 of them run over this season. The road's already built. Commuters are using it. It's not a situation where advanced planning could avoid this. We don't seem to have a culture that cares about this kind of thing. Do you have any idea what we can do as concerned citizens that might be effective?
In Tilden Park, so some of you East Bay people know this, there is a sign that says Newt Crossing. Of course, that's not on a busy thoroughfare, which it sounds like what yours is. I mean, I know they've mitigated in the deserts of Southern California for the desert tortoise, where they've funneled the tortoises underneath the freeway so they can pass easily from one side to the other. And I have no idea. But you're right. I mean, nobody cares about newts. They're little squishy things. They're ugly. And the eye of the newt is, you know, Shakespeare used that as a witch's brew cauldron. And that's disappointing. It's interesting that there's 2,600. I mean, the only way I could think of it is you have a bunch of newt volunteers put an article out in the newspaper, and you'll get people – sorry, Michael. You'll get people, you know, perhaps could facilitate movement of newts across
– There are better examples of Michael Ellis's humor. He's writing in Bay Nature about earthworms. We may talk about earthworms. And he says, you know, the great thing about being an earthworm, you're hermaphroditic, so you don't have to worry about a date on Saturday night.
That's true.
That's a good line. Let me thank the caller, and we'll get more callers aboard here.
You can use that,
Michael. Actually, she mentioned deserts, and I want to talk to you a little about deserts because you go to the Mojave all the time, and that's high desert. And you also spend a good deal of time, as I recall, and as I still think is the fact, going to the low desert of what am I thinking about here?
Anza Borrega.
Yeah, but no, closer in Southern California.
Sonoran.
No, Death Valley.
Death Valley, yes.
Yeah. So they're really, like I say, high desert, low desert, but you're really drawn and you like to take these footloose forays and trips to the deserts. What is it about the desert, I mean, particularly in terms of the life that's out there, that draws you?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, just to – the Mojave Desert is considered a high desert compared to Anza Borrega or the Sonoran Desert. And within the quote-unquote high desert is the lowest part in the Western Hemisphere, which is Badwater and Death Valley. So it's a little confusing. It's the micro and mega. So – the desert is really wonderful because you can get down on your belly and you can see these little tiny flowers, annuals that are growing. And then you glance up and you can see like 170 miles in the distance. And you can see something that's an annual plant that's responding to certain environmental conditions, which we have this year, by the way. It's a super bloom in Anza Borrega. And then you can glance up and see a rock that's 1.8 billion years old. So there's the contrast. And the other thing is I grew up in Tennessee and it's full of vegetation, and you can't walk anywhere unless you have a trail. And the desert is so nice because you see a distant mountain and you go, I want to walk there. And there's nothing to stop you from doing that. And I just like that feeling of expansiveness and openness.
It's like a freedom feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, and people look at the desert as a wasteland, but it's not. It's really...
They also look at it as a spiritual place. Richard Rodriguez, local wonderful writer, and former commentator on PBS used to say, actually, I think it was the last book which we featured on Forum, talked about how the desert is associated with the major religions of the world, the Abrahamic religions, Muhammad, Jesus, Moses, all creatures of the desert.
That's right. And if you go with me, I can lead you in the desert. We can get lost. Some of the best satyrs, by the way, I've ever had have been in the desert. It's easy to get salt and bad water, and there's no shortage of bitter herbs.
You come from a satyr background in Tennessee?
No, I'm kind of honorary Jew.
Well, we're going to take more of your phone calls. Let me remind you that we're talking to Michael Ellis, naturalist and wilderness guide with Footloose Forays, and we do welcome your involvement in the program. What questions do you have about the Bayer wilderness and where to go and what to do in your next excursion? Before we get some more callers involved here and talk further, I want to go far afield a bit for Footloose Forays goes far afield to so many places. I was reading about what you were doing in these, three great bioregions of the planet in Brazil. I mean, people don't even realize how much mammalian life there is down there and how much there is to see there. I'm talking about Amazon, Cerrado, and Pantanal?
Pantanal.
I mean, it's just we were thinking about the fact that Brazil is not exactly a place that invites people now because of the government, because of the fact that there's so much crime, particularly in Rio and São Paulo. But you're taking them to a different world in Brazil, a world within the world of Brazil.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've just had a granddaughter born 6 months ago, so I'm slowing down. So I'm only going
to... Mazel tov to the honorary Jew.
Thank you. I'm only going to do, in the future, at least foreseeable future, two international trips anymore for my little business. And one is to Tanzania, which I love, and the second is to Brazil. And in Brazil, places I go are the best place to see wildlife in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, the Amazon Basin is loaded with wildlife, but the problem, quote-unquote problem, is that it's very difficult to see, whereas the Pantanal is the world's largest tropical wetland, although the people in Botswana would argue with that with the Okavango Delta. But you have an opportunity there to see, nowadays, guaranteed jaguars, capybaras, caimans, giant anteaters, sloths, all several different species of monkeys, and it's open and easy to see. So that's it's a little bit like the African savanna in a way, that it's open, whereas the Amazon basin, full of trees and canopies and dense cover, which is beautiful, but it's difficult to see things. So this particular trip that I do is in the state of Mato Grosso, which is about the size of Texas. It's huge. Brazil, by the way, is equal to it's the same exact size as the United States, including Alaska. It's a huge country. So we go to the Pantanal, which is Portuguese for swamp. It's beautiful. And then we go to something called the Cerrado.
Pantanal is about the size of Georgia, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And Georgia, by the way, is the largest state east of the Mississippi River. That'll be on the quiz, Michael. And then we go to the southern Amazon basin. So we do get a little bit of the Amazon. So there's three different, very distinct ecosystems that I do in this relatively short period of time, just a little over 2 weeks. It's a fantastic country. And we just go through Sao Paulo. We don't stop there. And you're totally right. It's a dangerous place. And also the right-wing president just elected is very disappointing to those of us that care about the wild things of the planet, in particular Brazil. So
I don't want to give Brazil a bad name for tourism or anything, but I was in Portugal last year and was with a lot of Brazilians, and they were saying they won't even go in the streets of Brazil anymore. But you mentioned Tanzania in 1982. You've been going every year since 1982 to Tanzania, and talking about wildflowers, we got some abundant desert flowers this spring in Tanzania, which are blooming, I know, and and you had a near-death experience there with a buffalo.
Yeah, that was a while ago. Yeah,
You didn't want to talk about that, huh?
Well, I just had a Cape Buffalo, which, the irony is people are concerned when they go to East Africa or Southern Africa about the predators, spotted hyenas or leopards or lions killing you. And actually, most people die as a result of vegetarians, which would be hippopotamuses, and Cape Buffaloes. And they kill you, but they don't eat you. So I did have I've had two actually close experiences with Cape Buffaloes. And the last one was several years ago where it came charging out of the bushes right at me. But I'm here to tell
you. The Snows of Kilimanjaro has a story by The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber, which came immediately to mind by Hemingway. But you've also managed to create what I would call a reputation as a hula hoop artist, if that is not oxymoronic. And weren't you on a termite I know you were because I saw a photograph of it, unless it was a doctored photograph. A termite mound in Botswana, juggling elephant, for lack of a better word, shall we say, hardened feces?
Or we could just say turds. Yes,
I don't know if that's FCC.
I think it's okay, right? Yeah, they're thumbs up, I see. So I do hula hoop. I bring it all over the world, and it kind of, you know, they see this old guy hula hooping, and I give the hula hoop to people to try. And my hula hooping claim to fame is that I hula hooped on top of Kilimanjaro in 2010.
Well, you've hula hooped all over the world. The other thing, I keep learning things whenever I have you on. The other thing I learned about, we were talking about earthworms before, and I read that article in Bay Nature, that there are actually worm-charming competitions in England. And a young woman you wrote about who has a record breaker for that. You've got to have to fill me in on this. How do you charm worms exactly?
I know. This is the nice thing about writing for Bay Nature magazine is they have these questions that come up, and then I get to research them and learn things as well as I'm writing the articles. So there's people that apparently when you – and the question actually was, why do worms come up after it rains? And so as a kid, and probably like a lot of people, I thought, oh, it rains and they're going to drown. Well, worms can't drown. They can live underwater for weeks at a time. But apparently the tapping of the rain drops on the soil is imitative. Now, this is speculation. Obviously, we can't ask a worm to answer this question fully. But it's thought that their primary predator underground would be like a mole, which would be digging through the soil to eat a worm. And this tapping is thought to remind, if you will, an earthworm of a mole heading toward it. So what it does is it rises up to the surface and gets at the surface during the rain. Now, that does two things. One is it avoids predation, and the two is you have more opportunities to meet other worms, and so you can move faster at the surface. And then if you encounter, as you said, another hermaphrodite, bingo, you know, you can exchange gametes. And
there's always Edgar Allan Poe, the tap, tap, tapping at my chamber door.
And that's where the worm charming comes from. People have special sticks that they use, and they tap and see how many worms that they can get to rise to the surface. And apparently this young woman, 12 years old in England, holds the record. And it's, of course it's in England. Where else would that take place? A little like 3x3 bit of square, and then they tap and then count the number of worms that come up within X number of times. So she holds the world's record, which I believe it's like 272 worms or something like that. It's kind of amazing.
A lot of bait. Let me get our callers on. Gina. Gina, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to point out a lot of parks that we have in South County that are endemic to serpentine soils. And so they have a large spray of good wildflowers around this season. Santa Teresa County Park has a lot of serpentine soil, along with Calero County Park. Coyote Lake County Park also has good wildflowers, and a lot of the Santa Clara County Open Space Authority has a lot of parks in South Bay, and also Midpen Open Space.
Well, Gina, it's good of you to share that natural information with us, and I thank you for it. And we're going to get another caller aboard here. Susie from Alameda, hi.
Hi. My question is, I live in senior housing, and a number of us are limited with mobility, and I use a cane, and I have some good friends that use, is that echoing? Sorry.
Well, I don't hear an echo. No.
I have some friends that are, they use walkers to get around or scooters, and I wondered, is there a place that's easy access for handicapped that we might view waterfalls? In the Bay Area. We live in Alameda.
The magazine that I write for, Bay Nature Magazine, has a whole section on accessibility. And so what I would suggest, you contact that magazine because they have figured out how you could take public transportation, which trails are physically accessible, and what the trails look like. And I'm sure they could lead you to some relatively accessible waterfalls. And thanks for that because, I mean, a lot of us, if we continue to live, we're going to get less and less mobile. So there's going to be more and more need for opportunities for those of us to get access to those beautiful wild places, which is really, really important for your mental health, is to be in nature.
And thank you for the call, Susie. We've got some comments coming in. Amanda says, any great places for hikes along public transit routes? We have no vehicle and are in the North Bay.
Perfect. Yes. And that's just what I mentioned with Bay Nature Magazine. They have a beautiful, they had a dedicated one of their whole issues, actually, I forgot what year it was, to exactly that question. So you can take, and nice thing with the smart train now is, you know, you get off the smart train in Novato and you cross to the east, there's a huge amount of open space right there, which is really easily accessible.
You know, when you were talking about having a grandchild, I know you are a champion of the environment and have said many things about climate change. And Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has brought up this whole question about should people have children if the planet is, you know, burning up or it's going the way of the warrior, as we used to say. And here's a question for you from a listener named Derek along these lines. Says, how does Mr. Ellis reconcile running an international travel company with a concern for climate change?
Oh, wow. That is such a good question. Next question. No, Derek, you know, I've thought about that a lot, actually. And my ecological footprint is huge because of especially the air travel when I get people to go across the planet, you know, like every year.
You're making money off of carbon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do the, you know, guilt trip, plant trees and stuff like that.
Don't pick wildflowers.
I don't pick wildflowers. No, but that's a really good question. And I actually don't have an answer for that. I mean, I don't have an – all I can say is that there is a benefit to transferring wealth from the north to the south in terms of, you know, helping people, like, for example, in Tanzania, recognize that the economic relationship between the preservation of the wild things in this place, like the Serengeti, for example, and all the animals, and their economic well-being. And the only way you can facilitate that without actually extracting it, that is, killing the animals, is for ecotourism. And the question is a very good one. Is the benefit of what I do and I gift people, is that a positive or is that a negative? And I actually don't have an answer for that question.
I'll give you another easy question.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
No, it occurred to me. I just saw a picture that went viral of a huge, beautiful elephant that was shot by some safari group. You know, kill this animal, whatever animal you want to kill, we'll take you on the safari. Mm-hmm. We know that Trump's sons are big on this kind of hunting and so mm-hmm. forth. But it was a meme, and it went viral because they wanted to name the safari company, name the hunters, and, you know, make people aware of what's going on out there. But policy, what can we do? People get very exercised about this,
well,
understandably.
Yeah. I mean, elephants are one of African
not only elephants, but, you know, so much wildlife.
Yeah. But African elephants in particular have a very deep and complicated emotional life that's comparable to human beings in terms of their sensitivity.
You've read Jeffrey Mason, When Elephants Cry?
Yeah. And they're very powerful beings. And that being said, there are some places where elephants are overpopulating and destroying the environment, and culling may be necessary for preservation of some of the other species, in particular rhinos. So it all depends on how this is done, and it's complicated, and we're playing God. And so the question is, the demand is what needs to be removed, actually.
Yeah. Just like drugs.
Exactly.
Talking to Michael Ellis, we'll talk more with him. And we're also going to talk with Senator Mike McGuire about a big project that's underway. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and with me in studio for this hour is Michael Ellis, naturalist and wilderness guide for Footloose Forays. And if you have a question for Michael or would like to talk with him, we do invite you to join the program. Again, I'll say it toll-free, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. We welcome your calls. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And again, toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. Before we go back to your calls and back to conversation with Michael Ellis, I want to welcome State Senator Mike McGuire of Northern California's 2nd District, which spans from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border, and I want to talk with him about plans to turn the 300-mile North Coast Railroad line into the Great Redwood Trail. And welcome, Senator McGuire. Good to have you back with us.
Hey, good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Well, this is quite a project that's in the works here, and it is in the works because they're going to actually convert the decaying rundown railway into a 320-mile pathway for mainly walking, cycling, horseback riding. But we're talking about really from San Francisco Bay to Humboldt Bay, aren't we?
You're absolutely spot on. It is 320 miles, starting in Tiburon, ending up all the way in Arcata. It is mostly decaying. You still have the remnants of an old locomotive along with its cars in the Eel River. And this trail is going to be very similar to the Appalachian Trail that will be popular with cyclists and equestrian lovers as well as hikers. And the cool part of all of this, it's going to take folks through some of the most spectacular sceneries on Earth. You're going to be able to see old-growth redwoods, hike through the vineyards in Sonoma County, and through the golden rolling hills of Mendocino. And it's going to be a significant economic driver. California's outdoor recreational economy is worth $92 billion a year and growing. 700,000 jobs are dependent on the outdoor recreational economy. And the reason why I bring that up, Michael, this trail will traverse through some of the most impoverished small communities in the state and will help them be able to get out of poverty.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And portions are already built, really, up in Ukiah and Willits and Humboldt Bay itself and Arcata, as you said. What about the next steps?
So there's several next steps. Number one, we are going to be winding down the North Coast Rail Authority, who currently oversees the 320-mile line. They're functionally bankrupt.
Aren't they in debt about $12 million?
$12 million. The state has launched an audit. That audit will be completed by June 31st of 2020. We're about to launch the trail master plan process. That master plan is going to determine how much it's going to cost to be able to construct some of the most rural stretches of the trail and what the ongoing operations and maintenance will be. But most importantly, we're going to start with a community-wide discussion. We already have a May 4th town hall and trail summit up in Humboldt County. June 22nd, we're going to be hosting a town hall in Mendocino County, and it's going to be focused on those neighbors who are abutting the trail, and getting public comment. We want to hear what folks want to see on what will become a world-class trail. And then finally, this has already been funded. So the state has put $7 million into last year's budget to be able to advance the public portion of this. And about $70 million this year alone will be invested in five different segments of the Great Redwood Trail. So it's moving full steam ahead.
And you've got the easement survey up ahead as well?
We do. As you can imagine, there's nearly 2,000 property owners that are along the trail. And over the last century, folks have tended to creep up onto the trail and extend their backyards or their vineyards. And so we need to be able to do a comprehensive boundary survey on all 320 miles. That's going to take some time, and obviously it's going to take some effort to be able to gain that right away back.
Well, as my dad used to say, you're taking it slow, and I understand that. But a lot of the details are unknown, and nevertheless, we're talking about the likely draw of about, well, tens of thousands of tourists.
You are absolutely correct with that. When we take a look at the greatest demand for sports and recreation in this state, it's actually migrating away from organized sports as the state ages. And the most pent-up demand that we see is for passive recreation, cycling, hiking, jogging, and that is why we have been pushing so hard to create the Great Redwood Trail. This trail is going to attract visitors and locals alike. We anticipate in the first few years, tens of thousands of folks will come from across the globe to be able to traverse this trail. And I can't oversell how spectacular the scenery is. And Michael, it has been decades since humans have been through the Eel River Canyon on this stretch of rail. And it's going to be the first time in two generations that some Californians will be able to see some of the most rugged country on Earth. And it is going to be absolutely spectacular. And the great piece, it's also going to be an economic driver for rural California.
Yeah, as I said, it's very exciting, but no estimated time of completion. And could you say something about the challenges ahead?
Challenges ahead, we're going to need to be able to work with our neighbors, the property owners, all along the trail, number one. Number two, it's going to take some time. We are working through some really rugged areas of the state with some of the most geological unstable soils on Earth through the Eel River Canyon. So we're going to need to be able to phase this both for budget as well as for practical reasons of being able to build it out. But I think here's where I'm so thrilled. Michael, you see the beauty of the North Coast, but behind the Redwood Curtain, there's extreme poverty. And we have been talking for decades about bringing economic development to our small and rural communities, and this is what we need. We need to be able to bring folks into the communities and to be able to enjoy what we have and help folks get out of poverty that they're in. And that is why we are so thrilled that we're already funding the Great Redwood Trail and moving this project forward.
Well, good luck with it. And it is exciting, as I said, State Senator Mike McGuire in Northern California's 2nd District talking about plans for a Great Redwood Trail. Thank you for joining us, Senator McGuire.
Thanks, Michael.
What do you think, Michael Ellis?
Well, I was wondering why can't they have the rail and the trail, actually, but probably they've already thought about that. But it'd be nice to have a railroad that went along with it as well as the trail. But that would, yeah, that'd be cool. Although I've been on the Appalachian Trail, and you can't really bike on the Appalachian Trail that I know of. And I also love the fact that he called hiking, biking, cycling passive recreation. I was thinking, well, what's active recreation?
Horseback riding.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay.
Well, we're talking again about beauty and adventure, Bay Area wilderness, all kinds of subjects natural with naturalist and wilderness guide for Footloose Forays, Michael Ellis. Getting questions about where to take kids this spring, best places to go. Any recommendations, especially for places to bike with kids, that passive recreation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, kids are wonderful. I mean, the beauty of children is they engage wherever they happen to be. So you don't need to take them to anything totally spectacular or far away. So, and probably the less time you can spend in the car and the more time you can spend outside with them, the better. So all of those would depend on where you lived. I, unfortunately or fortunately, have a North Bay bias, sort of like you do. So most of the places I'm familiar with are in the East Bay, or excuse me, are in the North Bay, Marin County and Sonoma County. But Tilden in the East Bay is a really wonderful place to bike. Point Reyes at the Visitor Center, that trail that goes out to Divide Meadow, that's a really nice, wonderful place to bike. But almost anywhere you take children in nature. And, you know, 3 years ago, Stanford did a study that said walking in nature for 90 minutes a day is a significant reduction in depression. And more information is coming out about how vital wild places are to mental health of people, and even more so in our urban environment, with the cacophony of all the activities that we're doing. And the more you can get out into nature, the better you feel about everything.
I want to read a comment from a listener who's named Teal, who says, I'm sure this was not Michael's intent, but his comment about being able to walk anywhere in the desert because of lack of vegetation might lead people to think it's okay to do this. In fact, the desert has a fragile crust that is critical to the ecology of the region, and walking on it destroys crucial resources.
Yeah, she's speaking of what's called cryptogramic soil. That's a fancy word for it. And she's totally right. I mean, there's places where there's a whole number of microorganisms that have created, and mountain biking communities are very cognizant of this. That's why, you know, in some of the places where a lot of mountain biking occurs, they're working really hard to remind people to stay on the trail. So I appreciate that. Yes, and this would be places, obviously, where other humans have walked before, and you wouldn't want to walk on cryptogramic soil. So thank you for that, Teal. I appreciate it.
And here's Philip. Philip joins us from Oakland. Philip, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. First, I want to say it's the show of the Michaels. And so very, very good show. I like so I didn't expect to hear Senator McGuire, but that was – what a great idea, Redwood Trail.
They're all Michaels.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was saying. I'm not. But I wanted to bring up – you mentioned – so, you know, I love Marin. I live in the East Bay. I grew up in Marin. And I just want to – I don't want to rain on your parade. It sounds like you have a great business and a lot of fun, but you mentioned Alamere Falls, and do you feel partly responsible? I mean, I don't blame you, because it's a big issue. You know, I feel like the wild places have been overrun, and I don't want to limit people to not going, but Alamere in particular is like a zoo. I mean, I went out there, and I was shocked last year. It was unrecognizable because of the amount of people going out there and the trash and people defecating. I mean, it was really disappointing, and I think we all bear a little responsibility trying to protect the wild places. And so I think, I don't know if you have any ideas about how to do that. And so I'll just take your comments off the air. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. Michael Ellis.
Well, he just did it. Who wants to go out there now? Good work, Philip. Yeah, never mind on Alamere Falls. We can't go there anymore. But I know what you're talking about. Actually, the park services in throughout California have an expression. They call it sunsetification. And that's referencing Sunset Magazine. You know, after they published something called Secret Places of Anza Breggat, well, duh, they're not secret anymore. And so you're totally right. I mean, we love places to death. You're right. And I don't have an answer for that because
you can't even park in Muir Woods anymore, you know.
Well, that's true. I mean, and there, you know, there's a reason we want a constituency to protect wild places. So we want people to have a connection to these things. At the same time, we also want, selfishly, for us to have a very positive, solitary, potent experience by ourselves.
Yeah, good luck with the population rising the way it is.
Well, exactly. But he brings up interesting points.
He does.
In fact, the whole hour has been interesting points.
Rennie wants to know, where are good Bay Area dog-friendly hikes with minimal or ideally no poison oak?
Oh, I see. Well, quit petting your dog after it runs off-leash. Anyway, that's one of my pet peeves, so to speak. I know Marin Municipal, Marin Open Space has some places where dogs are allowed off leash. But, if you don't like poison oak, you're going to have to go above that 5,000 feet in the Sierra Nevada where there's no poison oak, or anywhere east of the Sierra Nevada there's no poison oak. Other than that, we don't really have a state bush. But I thought if we did, I would promote the poison oak as the state bush because it grows.
It's ubiquitous.
Well, yeah, and it grows, a vine form all the way up 80-foot redwood trees, you have poison oak growing. Along the coast, when you're picnicking, you suddenly look down and there's a prostrate form of poison oak. And then they have shrubs in some places that can be, good grief, like 15 feet high. So it's a very potent, powerful, ubiquitous plant. So good luck.
I wonder if you can be immune to poison oak. I shouldn't say this because I'll probably, next time I go out on any kind of foray, I'll probably get poison oak, but I've been exposed to it with friends who reacted to it and were affected by it, and it's never
You're lucky.
Afflicted me. I don't know if it's luck or it's genes or what.
Yeah, I think people change through time. When I was a kid, I was really allergic to poison ivy, which has the same kind of chemicals on the surface. And I can get poison oak if I really mess with it, like cut it or clear shrubs or something like that. But I'm like you, casually brushing against it, I don't get it. Other people, all they have to do is look at it and they get systemically.
That's true. Let me get some more callers aboard here, though. Lots of people want to talk to you, and Jim is next. Jim, welcome.
Yeah, great show, Jim and Pacifica. I would like to just speak with you guys about the multitude of open spaces available just south of San Francisco from Pacifica, actually down to Tanitas or San Gregorio. We've got the GGNRA very active in land acquisition and holding with Sweeney Ridge, Maury Point, and all of these lands are along the SamTrans bus line, which makes it accessible to kids. You just spoke about that. We've got some great beginner rides at Pillar Point Bluff, Devil's Slide Trail, Early Murray State Park for, fairly easy, flat, wonderful view, bicycle rides. And the one person asked about the dog-friendly areas, and that is one aspect of open space that we really strive to make sure that you can bring your dog to Pacifica and Point South. Petit Point Headlands was just picked up by the Pacifica Land Trust. It's over 400 acres directly south of Pacifica, and it's got some fantastic views of the ocean.
Jim, you could work for the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Yeah, you did? Okay, well, that makes sense. All right. Thank you for those recommendations.
Well, the Devil's Slide Trail is really cool because, when they did the bypass there, so there's this great trail that's very dramatic that many of us negotiated for years heading south on Highway 1, and now you can walk it or bike it, as Jim said.
Here's Randy, who asks, can you please tell us again about the special falls up behind Casadero or the Casadero area?
Yeah, I do a trip up to that part of the world at a place called The Cedars, which is actually not cedars. They're Sargent Cypress trees. But it's the greatest serpentine outcropping in all of western Sonoma County. There's 5,000 acres of exposed serpentine. It's really spectacular. I get to go in there, special arrangement with the people that own it. And
how'd you work that out?
Oh,
quid pro quo?
Kind of like you do. It's nice to know people. Right, that are in control of things. Yeah, and above Casadero, that would be the West Mark West. No, Mark, not Mark West. Oh, I can't think of the name of the creek. Yes, up there, it's really nice waterfall. Duh, that didn't really answer the question, did it?
Well, you pretty much gave a map that can be looked up on Google or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's get another caller on. Lucinda joins us. Lucinda, hi.
Hi. Good morning. I took a hike with Michael a few years ago on Sea Ranch coastline. It was terrific.
Oh, yeah.
With Land Path. I would love for you to describe the activity of Land Path and your involvement with them. Thank you.
Well, that's great. Yeah, so I'm on the board of an organization called Land Path, a 501c nonprofit, and we connect people with land. Especially working to outreach the Hispanic community, which is, you know, the demographic that's increasing in throughout California, or actually throughout the country. And we do a lot of school activities with programs with school children, bringing them out to the land. And one of the things we're also working on right now is called Trek Sonoma, which is modeled on sort of the idea that you have in New Zealand where you can trek from place to place. So our plan right now is to have a way to hike all the way through Sonoma County, north from south to north, and stopping along the way at Airbnbs or nice restaurants. And that's what we're working on right now. So, and that's a great organization called Land Paths. Thank you.
You're called a naturalist and wilderness guy, but you're really an educator.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do. I mean, people love learning. They're engaged that way, and it's and also people like to have joy and have fun. And, you know, part of the heaviness of what's going on in the world right now is ameliorated by understanding that you're only here one time. How can you embrace and be alive as you possibly can? Nature is one way to do that. Travel is one way to do that. And it's important to keep one ear open to what's going on, but it's also really important to find joy in everyday activities, whatever that happens to be.
There is a nice crystallized philosophy from Michael Ellis. Catherine wants to know specifically, what's your favorite trail in Mendocino?
Oh, well, you know, when I go to Mendocino, I hug the coastline because that's what I find the most dramatic about Mendocino. I also used to do trips in what's called the Angelo Preserve, which is on the South Fork of the Eel River. It's part now of the UC Natural Reserve System, where students from all over the UC system can do primary research on relatively pristine environment. And that's a really wonderful place you can get access to. It's called I think now it's called the Angelo Preserve, which is right outside of Laytonville in major dope-growing country. But it's probably about 7,000 acres of relatively pristine environment. And the U.S. Geologic Survey has a streamside monitoring there where they're monitoring a stream, which is how streams used to be before Westerners came and screwed everything up.
I wish I could remember a place I hiked up there not that long ago. I was a writer-in-residence up there, and Mendocino has an annual terrific writers' event that took us to this private place that I had never been before or never even heard of.
Jug Handle Creek?
No.
That's another good one, by the
way. No, but it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. You get on the air, you don't get prepared for these questions. There's no editing here. There's no net.
And
then
telling
you look
me.
Them up afterward. Yeah. Well, you've got most of the answers. Here's Craig from Oakland who wants an answer. Wants to talk about Eel River. Craig, go ahead.
Good morning. I wanted to talk about a trip that we did when I was a Humboldt State student, where we hopped the rails, this train that you're talking about, from Arcata all the way down to we're trying to get to Willits, and basically the owner of the train followed the train and noticed that a couple of boys had jumped on the lumber racks, and he asked us to get off in Scotia. And I talked my friend Buck into, I said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip. As soon as the owner turned his back, we stayed on the train, and we rode that train I think we finally hopped off in near Leggett.
You were like the old hobos.
With that, I'm
sorry? I say you were like the old hobos. You know, they used to just...
Well, that's what we had, you know, read Woody Guthrie, and we were feeling like hobos. And I'll say it is the most spectacular scenery. It's very... The problem with that was the train itself. It's some incredible... dangerous curves, and half the time I think they were repairing the track, so that's one of the reasons it's no longer probably functional.
That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. Good for you.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. Good to hear from you, Craig. Thank you for the call. Bob wants to know, Oakland and the East Bay have incredible parks with redwoods and dormant volcanoes. Talk about minimum time in the car. And let me get another caller aboard here.
Yeah.
That's Ed from San Jose. Ed, join us.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I have a suggestion for a wonderful family-friendly bicycle ride.
Great.
In Santa Clara County.
Go ahead.
Recommend the Coyote Creek Trail that begins at Hellyer Park and goes all the way down to Anderson Dam.
Oh, yeah. That's a great idea.
And the plan is to extend the park northwards all the way to Kelly Park, but that hasn't happened yet. So the only disadvantage is you have to go down to the south end of San Jose to Hellyer Park to begin your trip.
Well, thank you, Ed. Again, we get great suggestions from listeners and wonderful recommendations of places to see. Here's Olivia who writes, is there some truth to the warning about a significant uptick in Amanita mushrooms? Is the guest aware of key characteristics that separate the poisonous mushrooms from, well, the non-poisonous ones?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the poisonous ones kill you and the non-poisonous, no.
Yeah, but it's hard to tell them from the non-poisonous.
Well,
they mimic them.
Yeah, well, the Amanitas, phthaloides is the one she's referencing right now, where dogs have been eating those things. And they're a non-native mushroom which is spread in the Bay Area, and they have a... what they call a vulva, which is where the stem comes out, and they have an annulus, which is the little ring that's around them, and sometimes they have what looks like little egg white on top of them. So once you get kind of the mental image of this, and I was at, actually speaking of the East Bay, I was at Redwood Regional Park yesterday on my I have a regular Monday hiking group that's been going forever, and we hiked there, and there was warning signs for dog owners, because apparently some dogs have been eating these mushrooms and dying, suffering liver failure.
There should be warnings for human beings, too.
They are, but humans usually don't eat these things.
Some do, though. I mean, they think they're kind of experts in lichen and mushrooms.
Well, there's
amateur experts.
Well, there's an adage, which is there are old mushroom eaters and bold mushroom eaters, but there are no old, bold mushroom eaters.
Yeah, there's one for the books. Let's talk a little bit about a few other things while we have you here. You've made some recent discoveries in the Farallones.
Oh, this is so exciting. I was talking to my friend Grant, chief scientist at Point Blue, which formerly was called the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. And Atlantic puffins, they discovered their bills glowed fluorescent under ultraviolet light. Okay, so what does that mean? Birds can see in ultraviolet light. And so all of a sudden they found, wow, puffins, who thought to put a black light on a puffin to start with? But they found this, and so with trembling fingers, the biologist at Point Reyes captured a few rhinoceros auklets, and they have a little horn at the base of their bill, hence the name, and they put them under a black light, and sure enough, they glow. And nobody knew this for years, and this was just recently discovered out at the Farallon Islands. Now, why is another question. The presumption is it has something to do with sexual breeding and activity, you know, maybe identifying species. So it's something that our eyes, or human eyes, are not sensitive to that part of the spectrum, but birds are. And so they see the glowing beak of the rhinoceros auklet, and maybe that means you're for me.
That's cool.
That is cool.
If they could use it at single bars or whatever.
Well, there's other things used at single bars.
What about a local whale-watching update? Listeners always eager to hear and find out where they can see the whales.
Well, I just talked to my friend Fiona O'Kelly, who's one of the rangers at Point Reyes National Seashore out at the lighthouse, and I asked her yesterday, and she said they're just now starting the northward migration. So we're talking gray whales right now.
Yeah.
It's a little early for the humpbacks and the blue whales. They're still down south or out in Hawaii breeding right now. But the presumably the newly impregnated females and the males that did it are on their northward migration heading back to the Bering and the Chukchi Sea, but it's just now sort of beginning. And a little bit later in the season, as I mentioned about Chimney Rock, mid-April into mid-May, you get an opportunity to see the cow-calf pairs who hug the coast really closely, and they're sort of dawdle, if you will, because the youngsters can't go as fast as their mom. So.
And before we actually have to say goodbye, I wanted to get your take on the elephant seals and the government shutdown.
That was great. That I was in Africa when that happened, and it showed up on a post that I had, which was the government shutdown. I missed all this stuff, thank goodness. And
didn't help our parks, Joshua Tree being a prime example.
Oh, that was awful. Anyway, so what the elephant seals, you know, it's kind of like where does an elephant seal go anywhere it wants to? Well, the rangers had been chasing them off at Drake's Beach because that, you know, just shaking tarps at them to get them to leave. But there was nobody there to do that. So essentially all the elephant females spilled over from Chimney Rock where they had been, quote unquote, confined and spilled out onto Drake's Beach. And I think there was like 100 pups born, something like that. So they took over this beach, which, you know, was great. I thought it was wonderful.
Let me ask you about one other species. A lot of people worried about the gray wolf, list of endangered species. What's going to happen?
Yeah. Well, you were just talking about the Trump administration. I tried, you know, to just be cognizant of it a little bit, but not let it. It's so toxic. But the latest toxic thing is they want to delist the gray wolf. And this is a prime predator. I just read a wonderful book called American Wolf, which is the whole story of the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park and the success that's followed and the conflicts between ranchers and the wolves and the people that are advocates for wolves. And it's sad because we should have room for that fantastic predator. And speaking of dogs, that's our first domesticated animal. This came from the wolf. We have a deep, long-term connection with this magnificent being.
We're going to have to come back. So much to talk about with you. Always a joy. Thank you for being with us. That's Michael Ellis, naturalist, wilderness guide, and his organization is called Footloose 4A. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.